Lifestyle Change and Health Enhancement, Dr. Weiss.
Thank you, Dr. Kearns. Ladies and gentlemen, it's very good to be back in Vancouver. I've been away too long. Fortunately for you, I didn't bring the weather we were having in Washington. Then you'd really feel badly. I debated about the title of this topic because lifestyle change and health enhancement in many ways is perhaps a little prosaic for this audience, given the fact that Canada has been the world leader in this area. I will therefore do my best not to preach to the choir. I thought for a while that perhaps one of the things we might use as a title was Lifestyle Change and Health Enhancement, : is there life after health? Perhaps as we go through this, we'll see both sides of that question. I'll have to get used to the technology that you face me with here, so bear with me if I push the wrong buttons. Let me begin by posing the question, why now? What is it about our present state of affairs that's made lifestyle and health such a central concern? After that, I'd like to turn to looking at precisely what we mean when we use terms like lifestyle, disease prevention, health promotion, and the like. Thirdly, who are we talking about? And finally, how do we see this happening? So why now, what, who, and how? A simple task for an hour's talk. Well, not everyone's perfect, and there we go, okay. Now, I just wanted to see whether everybody was paying attention. You are. That's wonderful. Let me briefly address two issues, and we'll come back to them in the course of the discussion, but just to draw your attention to them. The first one is the nature of the health challenge we face today. You know, historically, the great scourges have been the acute infectious diseases. During the past 50 years, through biologic breakthroughs and advances in instrumentation, psychotherapeutic advances, public health strategies, we have virtually eliminated these health hazards in the industrialized world. And I don't know if you can see that picture very well, but we're looking at measles and poliomyelitis, and in fact, we have eliminated these as a major threat, again, at least in the industrialized world. So today we have a different sort of a threat. We have heart disease, stroke, cancer, and accidents, which account for 2 out of every 3 deaths in North America. Even more importantly, they account for nearly 75% of the potential years lost from premature death. Now, as we discuss prevention later on, keep in mind that what we're really talking about is not prevention. You can't really prevent disease. We're really talking about delay, okay? You know, we have not found the key to eternal life. But we're very concerned with premature departures from this earth and with the morbidity which prevents one from experiencing life to the fullest. In other words, impairment of the quality of life. Okay, the second issue then that we just need to keep in mind are the health costs associated with these problems. In the US, the total expenditure for health in 1950 was $10 billion. It's a lot of money. But by 1972, this had climbed to $70 billion. And by 1980, we're talking about $247 billion. And so we have a situation As you see, our friends from the New Yorker. That's 9.4% of the gross national product of the United States, $247 billion. Of course, if President Reagan has his way, it may be a lot larger percentage of the what's left of the gross national product. That's disloyal, isn't it? At any rate, further, it has been estimated that if twice the money were available, we would only realize a 5 to 10% increase in the quality of health care. So clearly, throwing money at this problem is not going to solve it. The cost issue obviously has to be brought under control. Yet, how can we deny expenditures which have life-saving implications? The implementation of emergency medical services, coronary care units, and the recently developed highly sophisticated scanning and imaging diagnostic techniques have undoubtedly made major contributions to disease detection and treatment. Coronary bypass surgery alone, as an example of a technology unheard of 20 years ago, was performed 100,000 times in the United States last year at a cost of $17,500 per operation. That's nearly $2 billion of additional cost. Now, its life's prolonging capabilities are still somewhat in doubt, but we do clearly realize benefits in pain reduction and thereby enhance quality of life. Well, obviously, these innovations are expensive, and their refinements and their successors will undoubtedly be even more so. Is that sufficient reason to deny them to those in need? Obviously not. Although in some subsistence cultures, human life is valued somewhat below that of the family cow, we've made our choices on this issue very clear. Nuclear war notwithstanding, of course. So, what are we going to do? Well, I'm sure most of you have heard the story of the little village by a river, which one day witnessed a person floating down the river, obviously in serious difficulty, drowning being serious. Through heroic efforts on their part, the villagers swam out and they rescued this person. The next day, lo and behold, two more people were seen floating down the river, and again they jumped in and saved them. Soon, more and more people were found floating down this river, and the villagers, conscientious folk that they were, set out to develop increasingly innovative ways of rescuing these people coming down the river. And the villagers were very proud of these acquired skills, as they had a perfect right to be. Although not saving everyone, they became increasingly adept at surveillance. They devised ingenious safety nets. They built bigger and faster boats to meet the increasing number of potential drownees. However, the numbers continued to increase, finally threatening to overwhelm the resources of this little village. Only then did someone propose, why not take a look upstream and see who or what is throwing these people into the river in the first place? The answer, of course, was, we really don't have time, we're too busy saving lives. Well, this is the perennial problem between treatment and prevention. And this little story illustrates the basic thesis that we're going to consider tonight. While not challenging the desirability of treating those in need with the most effective tools at our command, to the extent that one can reduce the level of need, one may achieve the necessary control and cost containment without sacrificing quality of care. Well, that sounds simple enough. Kind of one of those, gee, why hadn't we thought of it before ideas? Well, but to accomplish this, there are many problems and vested interests to consider which sometimes prevent, at least temporarily, moving in directions which appear logical, rational, and obvious. Well, we'll discuss those as we go along. Let's consider the implications of a prevention strategy as a means of reducing the health cost burden then, and hopefully enhancing the quality of life. So first, what are we talking about? Second, who's involved? And third, how are we going to accomplish this? First of all, what do we mean by prevention? To prevent disease, you've got to have some idea of what's causing it. Otherwise, we're really playing witch doctor. Sometimes we do that anyway, but we shouldn't do it as a matter of course. And even if we don't understand the precise physiologic mechanisms involved, we need some idea of what's going on. And this is where epidemiologic studies have been particularly helpful in identifying markers and patterns of behavior associated with increased probability of disease. Now, the term probability is important to keep in mind, as there's no assurance that any given individual will or will not remain healthy by following certain regimens or engaging in certain behaviors. By gosh, you get all the doors locked, something sneaks up behind you, and there you go. But from infancy on, we are constantly making decisions based on probability estimates, whether we consciously think in such terms or not. We think we have some decision theorists here, so hopefully that rings a bell. And this is just another set of probabilities that we have to consider. So risk factors are just that, probability statements. Everybody can point to an uncle or an aunt in the family who smoked until they were 93 and healthy as a horse. And we'll continue to, undoubtedly. Probability statements. Now, the Canadian Ministry of Health in 1973 issued the first national policy statement implicating our Western way of life, the things that we eat, things we drink, whether we smoke, exercise, how we use and abuse drugs, no cartoon. How we cope with our increasingly urbanized pressure cooker way of life. They indicted all of these things as perhaps the major contribution to heart disease, cancer, and stroke, and other debilitating disorders. Now, let's remember where we are on this matter. Since 1900, the lifespan of the average North American has increased by 20 years. But if you, sorry, you can't see it, I'll interpret it for you. Let me get the pointer. But the lifespan for males, at least half the group, who reach the age of 45 has only increased by less than 3 years. And so if you look at these scales, you'll see here 1 to 14 years, tremendous. And of course, our infant mortality rate has gone down. Sorry, that's under 1 year. But look at the 25 to 64, just barely. And look at the 65 and over, hardly at all. All right, we're not really, frankly, terribly concerned about this. As I said before, you've got to die of something. And heart disease, frankly, is not a bad way to go when it's your time. But premature death, and that's this curve, we're really not doing nearly as much on that as we thought we were doing. So this tells us, at any rate, that the major health advances have affected the earlier years of life, childhood diseases, as we saw before, measles, most of the diseases which many times did take children at young ages. The acute infectious diseases, the ones where we got the magic bullet and we were able to immunize vast numbers of people. These are no longer the killers they once were. However, we're talking about chronic degenerative diseases For these, the solutions are not so simple. Or is that so? If I can figure out how to turn this on. Let's see how difficult this is. My gosh, it works. All right, we're talking about, I'd just like to share with you briefly, data from Bellick and Breslow, a study which was done down in Alameda County, 7,000 people, longitudinal study. We're talking about 7 personal health practices. And what are we talking about? Very complicated. They looked at these 7 practices and how many people practice these in their populations. The first, 7 to 8 hours sleep per night. The second, eat a regular breakfast. The third, eat 3 meals a day, no snacking in between meals. Sounds like your grandmother. The fourth, normal height-weight relationship. Not too fat, not too thin, so. Fifth, no smoking. Sixth, regular exercise. The seventh, moderate alcohol use. Now here we were talking about very complex biomedical discoveries that would save us somehow. And look at these. Well, what about them? What happens to that 45-year-old man? And 45-year-old woman. Well, looking at these practices, what Breslow did is they looked at the group of people who could score anywhere from 0 to 3 practices, and they put these into a group, and then those people who could identify with 6 or 7 practices and put them into a group. And they found that the people who identified 0 to 3 turned out to have a life expectancy in this longitudinal study of 67 years. 45-year-old men. 6 to 7 practices, 76 years. 11 years difference. 45-year-old women. 0 to 3 practices, 78 years. 6 to 7 practices, 85 years. 7 years difference, but women are so far ahead, we're never going to catch up anyway. They don't like to tell us about that, but we know. The conclusion that they reached was that the association between mortality and health practices was stronger than with physical health status or income level, two issues which we thought were quite important in terms of determining physical health status. Now, as coronary heart disease remains the number one killer of North Americans and accounts for approximately 50% of the total mortality, we'll illustrate our discussion of prevention with risk factors related to coronary heart disease. First off, what really is the magnitude of the problem? Let us suppose that on January 1st, 2 jumbo jets had a mid-air collision, and both crashed with a loss of over 500 lives. On that same day, 4 more jumbo jets crashed with over 1,500 people aboard, with all of these people sustaining serious injury. Now, a unique feature compounding this tragedy was that all of these people were between 30 and 65, the prime of life. January 1st, a real tragedy, no question. January 2nd, the same thing happened. Exactly the same thing. And the day after that, it happened again. And so on throughout the year, every single day of the year. We just have to look at what just happened in Washington to realize the tremendous amount of attention and concern that's focused on a situation when a plane crashes. We're talking about, though, a total of 183,000 premature deaths. Remember, we're talking premature deaths. And 570,000 injuries, which equals the number of heart disease and stroke morbidity and mortality victims claimed by these disorders, at an annual cost exceeding $40 billion. And when one recognizes the concerns and activity which was generated by Legionnaire's disease in 1976, some of you may remember, there's a total loss of 29 lives. Certainly a tragedy for those people, but when we're talking about relative tragedies, we have a real tragedy on our hands. But it becomes obvious that the dramatic quality that galvanizes people to action just doesn't exist in the case of chronic disease. Yet the magnitude of the problem has no parallel. And perhaps the enormity or the commonplace or fragmented occurrence of this problem has resigned us to its inevitability. Well, that's the question. Is it inevitable? Well, there are certain things that are inevitable. Death is inevitable and taxes are inevitable. However, remember, we're talking about premature death. And we're talking about our efforts are not to avoid it. We're not going to be able to avoid it, just to delay it. Now, the three most commonly accepted risk factors in coronary heart disease are smoking, hypertension, and elevated serum cholesterol levels. All of these obviously have lifestyle implications. Now, I'm going to assume that you're already familiar with most of the issues, and we'll run through those relatively briefly. But smoking, the never smoked, past only pipe or cigar, relatively low. But as soon as we go in, we can see that the rates climb rather dramatically. In hypertension, a similar trend. As you go up the scale, in terms of diastolic blood pressures, you see a marked and dramatic increase in blood pressure, in mortality. Cholesterol, similar pattern. These are not mortality, these are morbidity figures, I'm sorry. Now, let's just briefly run through some of these things just to try to give you a flavor of some of the issues involved. In smoking, for example, I haven't seen this one yet. Let me see. It's not that I have a suspicion. Why you haven't asked me to give up smoking? Okay, of the estimated 29 million Americans south of this border who stopped smoking between 64 and 75, it is estimated that 95% of these people quit on their own. Of all the risk factors, the dangers here are clearly the most evident, and the evidence is really the most unequivocal. You know, in coronary heart disease, they estimate that 25%, a full 25% of the mortality is directly associated with smoking. In lung cancer, you have 64,000 deaths, 45,000 of these premature deaths, of which 39,000 are considered directly related to smoking. Lung cancer poses literally 10 times the risk for smokers. We have a whole host of issues we need to think about. You've got occupational hazards. The asbestos worker, for example, is at a greatly increased risk because there's a synergistic involvement between asbestos and smoking. The birth control pills and smoking, again, a similar situation. There's a 10-time risk of myocardial infarction for women over 30 years of age, pill and smoking. Pregnancy. Been shown time and again, lower birth weight children, increased incidence of spontaneous abortion, increased incidence of fetal death, complications of pregnancy, congenital malformations, secondhand smoke. All of you parents who smoke, think about it. Your children are at higher risk. There's a greater risk of sudden infant death syndrome, for which there is no single cause that can be identified. Children just die. Upper respiratory infections, including pneumonia, tonsillitis, bronchitis. So we're not dealing with a simple factor of an individual who wants to exercise their own options. In smoking, we've got other issues involved. Interestingly, in the US, I hope it's the same in Canada at least, smoking seems to have stabilized among boys. It is decreasing in men. Unfortunately, there's been a significant increase with young girls. An increase of eightfold among 12 to 14 year old girls since 1968. I refer you to the Virginia Slims advertising. You've come a long way, baby. Yeah, not the right way. Tobacco industry spends over $500 million a year in advertising. There's one lesson we can learn from all this, though, at least we down in the lower 48. You don't fiddle with Mother Nature and free speech, First Amendment, and so on. We tried it, a little experiment. We decided that if we took advertising off of television and radio for cigarettes, then somehow that would improve things. Unfortunately, the anti-smoking forces in the free competitive environment were getting pretty darn sophisticated. I don't know if you had access to much of that, but there was one particular advertisement which caused me to stop smoking, and a lot of my friends who had young children, particularly boys, we were proud of and we wanted to grow up and see, reach maturity and have the quality of life we like, and it was called Like Father, Like Son. And it showed a father smoking a cigarette, dropping it down and walking away, and so his little toddler, who he was obviously very fond of, walked over, picked it up, and stuck it in his mouth. I saw my son do that once with a pipe of mine. That was it. So we're role models, too. We're role models as parents, we're role models as professors, we're role models as teachers, we're role models as superiors, a whole variety of things. Well, in terms of smoking, how successful have we been? Well, so much for Rube Goldberg. We haven't been terribly successful, frankly. As I said, most people stop smoking on their own, and the technology we have for smoking cessation has been fairly successful to get people to stop, but not to keep them stopped. And we'll get into that a little later. Hypertension. A very complex problem, but we're not talking about a little problem. We're talking about 40, possibly 60 million people in a country, again down there, of 220 million folks. 60 million people, I mean, that's a large number of population. 90% of those are considered essential hypertension. What does essential mean? It means we have no idea what's causing the elevated blood pressure, so we gave it a fancy name. We just conducted a study called the Hypertension Detection and Follow-Up Program, which demonstrated that the treatment of even mild hypertension will, in fact, reduce mortality. Well, what does this say? Well, unfortunately, in this trial, all these patients were on drugs. So it really didn't answer the question as to whether one could lower blood pressure by other means effectively and also reduce mortality this way. But yet, a very important question. Because think about it. We have traditionally used pharmacotherapy very effectively in the past, but we have used it for the acute disorders, or we have used it to ameliorate problems generally of old age, or we have used it to stay a particular situation until the body could regain its capability, its competence again. If its immune system was knocked out temporarily, we could protect it until. But here we're talking about something else. We're talking about indefinite usage of drugs over an indefinite lifetime period. And we're talking about not 70 and 80-year-olds, we're talking about 50-year-olds and 40-year-olds and 30-year-olds. And we're talking about drugs that have not small, not insignificant side effects. The short-term side effects, we know anything from dry mouth to impotence and a whole variety of things in between. It's the long-term side effects, though, we don't know. But we have seen enough evidence of people who chronically take drugs in their younger years, inevitably, we do start to find what happens, the side effects, and I haven't heard of any good ones. I've heard only horror stories. And I'm afraid if we're talking about a population of 60 million people, we're liable to hear a lot more unless we get more creative in the ways in which we deal with this. Nonetheless, it is important to reduce blood pressure, and we need to have the kinds of studies that will help us reduce blood pressure without a lifetime reliance on medication. However, medication is effective in reducing blood pressure, but for a whole host of reasons, including the side effects issues, it is not terribly effective at maintaining that lowered blood pressure because people have to stay on the drugs. And so I'll just show you one kind of study in which we are taking people whose blood pressure has been reduced into the normotensive range, and this is their medications right here, and through a series of non-pharmacologic approaches while they are on drugs have then transferred from a dependence on drugs perhaps to a dependence on non-pharmacologic approaches, but nonetheless through lifestyle changes, through stress management procedures, we have gradually been able to step down the drugs while maintaining blood pressures in approximately their same levels, even though occasionally here you see a lability in blood pressure, but you find that in fact it still is able to be maintained within the normotensive range and dependence on drugs has ceased. So it's not that drugs are bad, and it's not that we shouldn't use them. The question is how we use them. And so we have to be asking ourselves different questions. We cannot just unquestionably use drugs. We have to use them and use them as the most effective, but use them hopefully in a way that will allow us to have the best of both worlds. Use the drugs as an acute means as opposed to a chronic. Okay, cholesterol. Another complex story. Dietary cholesterol and serum cholesterol are not related on a one-to-one basis. Highly individual. Some people, anything they eat will show up in serum cholesterol levels. And others, we can eat anything and everything and it doesn't make any difference whatsoever. We found that the cholesterol story is a far more complex story. It's not just total cholesterol, but cholesterol, the fractions, lipoprotein fractions, which are part of the whole cholesterol picture, appear equally or perhaps more important. We have very low density lipoproteins, we have low density lipoproteins, we have high density lipoproteins. The high density lipoprotein seems to be acting in some way as a protective factor. And so we found, lo and behold, all the evidence, as I said, is there any life after health? There's got to be some good news in here. Moderate amounts of alcohol appear to stimulate HDL. Nobody drinks. Exercise seems to stimulate HDL. And recent studies suggest that very low serum cholesterol levels may enhance one's risk for cancer. So it's a very complex picture. And we have to be careful as we get into this that we don't start taking very simplistic approaches to it. Unfortunately, as impressive as all of this may be, it still accounts for less than 50% of the variants associated with the incidence of coronary heart disease. So there's a lot of other things going on there. And so we have to throw a wider net. And we're talking about things like obesity, physical fitness, stress, personality factors, alcohol, Alcohol can be a good and a bad. Other substances, such as indirect contributors, such as salt, caffeine. As I said, there are very few joys left. We found with caffeine, for example, that someone got, there was a big flurry of evidence that caffeine causes heart disease. Well, a lot of additional studies were done. No relationship. Science doing its thing. Yes, no, maybe, and what's the answer? However, someone did some rather interesting work down at the University of Southern California in which they started to look at caffeine and they started to look at stress and they realized, yes, both of these had a relatively mild effect, but by gosh, when you put them together, caffeine and stress caused a very profound reaction in terms of the cardiovascular system. A synergistic reaction which was greater than you would expect from either alone. So again, the picture is we need to take a very multifactorial approach if we're going to ultimately come to terms with this. So if you're going to drink lots of coffee, fine, but do it in a non-stressed environment. If you're going to be in a stressed environment, don't drink coffee. Okay, let's talk just briefly about obesity. First, the good news. For those of you who are considered 10 to 15% overweight, I couldn't resist that. That was amazing. For those of you who are considered 10 to 15% overweight, according to the Metropolitan Life Insurance tables, the tables have apparently underestimated ideal weight. I know there's some of you who would be happy to hear that. So the underestimation is approximately 15%. And as in many instances, recent studies have confirmed that too thin can be equally or more harmful than being too fat. You know, it's that old U-shaped curve. So the lowest disease risk regarding weight was noted to be in people approximately 15% heavier than the ideal weight depicted on the actuarial tables, and so they're revising the tables. Now, however, although increased risk for cardiovascular disease becomes evident when weight becomes over 30% above ideal, generally obesity is more closely related to angina pectoris, pain, rather than heart attacks or coronary death rate per se. However, obviously, obesity may indirectly contribute to other risk factors such as elevated blood pressure, glucose intolerance and diabetes, and sedentary lifestyle. Clearly, if you're very big, it's really hard to exercise. So the data, again, is not clear-cut, but nonetheless, the general medical, social, and personal undesirability associated with excess weight suggests that weight control be recommended as safe and prudent in disease prevention and health enhancement programs. In other words, the rule of reason, otherwise known as common sense, should govern our actions here in lieu of a more definitive statement from the scientific community. Now, in terms of treatment programs, we have these behavior modification programs, which have been quite effective in reducing weight, but again, less successful in keeping that weight off. Physical fitness. Okay, another area, that was the fatty. I had to throw the other one in. Sorry, let's use that. That one is, that's a picture of Harold, if you know any Harolds. and I believe, I'm sorry, that's a little difficult to see. The caption on the bottom there is, "Anything wrong?" because those two people were walking, and that's considered very unusual in this day and age. Okay. Well, physical fitness is obviously another area of scientific controversy. The physical conditioning exercise in its myriad forms have a quantifiable impact on health, longevity, quality of life, and so on. Does it prevent disease? Well, we can't render a scientific judgment in this area. We've got too much noise in the system. Age, diet, prior physical status, occupation, heredity, early developmental factors, sociocultural, socioeconomic factors, all of these impinge on the role of exercise and health. But let me share with you what little we know, and you draw your own conclusions. Animal studies that have been done, they've taken two groups, they've exercised one group and not exercised the others, subjected both of them to high-intensity environmental stress, of such an intensity that we would expect it would produce myocardial damage, stress-induced myocardial damage. The group that were non-exercised showed the expected myocardial damage. The exercise group showed no effects whatsoever. So in this case, exercise had a protective effect. Why? We don't know. We've seen enough studies now which suggest to us that exercise, in addition to seeming to make a lot of people feel good, does seem to have a difference. It does seem to make a difference. It certainly does increase HDL, high-density lipoprotein, which seems to act, if you were to think of your circulation as the oil system in your car, and you think of LDL, low-density lipoproteins, and VLDL as the sludge, think of HDL as your non-detergent component of your oil. In other words, it tends to keep things in suspension, and it doesn't allow them to adhere to the walls of your arteries, which, of course, is where the problem is. And so that's why we really think that increasing HDL by whatever means is possible does indeed have a protective effect. And Peter Wood in Stanford showed that exercised athletes, runners, joggers, in fact, showed significant increases of HDL. That study has been now replicated a couple of times. And however, his runners were running an average of 11 miles a week. Is that a lot?
I don't run.
Okay. And finally, one study again, which had interesting results, Paffenbarger and Stanford, showed a significant decrease in heart attack rates among those people whose energy output equaled 2,000 to 3,000 calories per week. And this was like walking approximately 3 miles a day, light exercise 6 hours a week, or strenuous exercise for 4 hours a week. So use that as a guide. However, clearly one of the things you must be careful of is please, please be careful. Don't be a type A and say, by gosh, if I'm going to exercise, go from sedentary lifestyle to highly vigorous exercise, because you'll probably do yourself in the effort. Take it slow, get your physician's advice, and do an appropriate job of conditioning yourself using dynamic exercises as opposed to static. That's isotonic versus isometric. We don't have time to talk about that, but you have exercise physiologists, I'm sure, who could help you to tell you about that. Finally, stress. Oh, stress. Okay. Many of you may be familiar with the concept of type A behavior. Well, we're not quite sure what type A behavior is, although most of us, in one form or another, do see certain elements of that in our own behavior. It's that very hurried, very impatient, sometimes very hostile, very competitive lifestyle, which does characterize much of what we consider appropriate in Western world for some reason. At any rate, we've seen an association. The association seems to be a real one. It's an epidemiologic association. It doesn't necessarily imply cause and effect. And even if it did, we still don't understand the precise linkage. But we do see an association between these. The key thing is that if, in fact, there's a behavior associated with a heart disease, if we change the behavior, are we going to change the heart disease? Or is the behavior just some sort of a marker? And no matter what we did with that, it wouldn't really matter. The markers, the physiologic process is independent. That we don't know. So these are things which still clearly need research before everyone starts using the fact that they have to train to be a type B as an excuse for not showing up for work. Please, I didn't say it. Okay, our urban Western lifestyle has placed a special burden on humans who are constructed pretty much the same way as we were 10,000 or even a million years ago. Yet clearly, we can't wall ourselves off from our environment, and even if we tried, would it be worth it? Therefore, we have three choices in terms of how we deal with stressors in our environment. You can be Sir George and attack it head on and master it, and beat it into the ground, maybe yourself as well. You can ignore it. I didn't see you, you didn't see me. Or you can try to reach some form of accommodation. Now, most of the stress management strategies have adopted for number three, in the form of developing more effective coping strategies in dealing with the stress-producing characteristics of our environment. Finally, I mentioned alcohol. There's good news and bad news. As I said, the good news is moderate amounts of alcohol do seem to stimulate high-density lipoprotein and has a protective effect. This we've seen from epidemiologic studies. The bad news, large amounts of alcohol have a toxic effect and clearly do accelerate cardiomyopathy. Although nutrition clearly also figures into this. People who tend to drink really excessive amounts don't handle their nutrition well, and so again, it's a more complex factor. All right. That's the what. Now, who's going to do it? Medical profession? They're already quite burdened with their present responsibilities, fishing people out of the river. Even if they weren't, would senior physician more often solve the problem? Well, certainly it wouldn't solve the cost issue, and again, medicine, medical profession does tend to be treatment oriented, although recently all right. Other health professionals, yes, sure, they can be of help. And there is a growing cadre of persons trained to provide various preventive health services. And they're going to be important and they'll be needed. But as the Lalonde report mentioned, when Mark Lalonde was Minister of Health in 1974, and myriad of other reports since then, the key factor in prevention of illness ultimately concerns the individual and his or her willingness to make the necessary changes in their way of living. In the immortal words of Pogo, we have met the enemy, and he is us. So, if we as individuals do have the ultimate responsibility for lifestyle change, how can we best conceptualize this using all the available resources to assist us? After all, we don't live in isolation from others or from our environment. And the health behavior issue needs to be further broken down into more manageable pieces. All right, which leads me to sharing with you what I'll call, for lack of a better name, the Weiss Cube, or Weiss's Folly, but it's not to be confused with the Rubik's. I'm not going to make that kind of money with it. What is this? For planning purposes, if we were going to talk about health behavior, remember we were talking about different things. We were talking about, in some cases, health behavior change, but health behavior maintenance was not effective. Sometimes we're talking about health behavior development rather than health behavior change. Clearly, we're talking about the fact that we, primarily, to the extent that we are going to enhance our health, perhaps delay some of the inevitable consequences we discussed, are going to be talking about health behavior change. But that's only part of the battle. Because anybody can change anything for a short period of time. But health behavior maintenance, and perhaps maintenance is really the key issue, is the issue we need to pay perhaps even more attention to. We've gotten pretty good at health behavior change. We can get people to stop smoking. We can get people to exercise more. We can get people to change their diets for a while. There's a very famous curve, and I'm sorry I don't have a slide of it. It's an inverted J. Anyway, think of an inverted J. In other words, it goes like this. And this part says, if you've gone through a health behavior change program, within 3 months you will be down here, within 6 months you will be over here, within a year you'll be over here. In other words, there's a slight recouping. But in smoking programs, one after another, you see roughly a maximum of 30% of the people are able to maintain. And we're only talking about the people who successfully quit, not the ones who dropped out. So, that's where the key problem lies. If only the problem were that simple, but of course, life never is that simple. So we want to further break this down. Into three functional levels, thinking of the intrapersonal, and environmental factors. At the intrapersonal level, we might look at things as values. Now we're talking about things that we say to ourselves, and the way we talk to ourselves about the things we want to do or we don't want to do. We're talking about our self-concept and how that enters into what decisions we make within this regard. For a child, we may be talking about health behavior development. An adult, we're talking about, again, the health behavior change and maintenance. In the interpersonal level, clearly your relationship with those people around you, family, friends, colleagues, superiors, subordinates, what have you. An environment, environmental, all of the different influences that our environment brings. Work, home, social environment, cultural environment, the climate, political, legal, what have you. And then, of course, to make things even more complicated, we could add even a third dimension, hence the cube. And so we could look at things in terms of what the individual does with regard to all of these factors. What role does the healthcare provider and the healthcare setting have to say about these areas? The school and work site, the community, etc. You could design this obviously in 101 different ways. But clearly there are many, many issues which need to be taken into consideration. But if we start to think in terms of intrapersonal, interpersonal, environmental, it gives us a little better idea of how we can plan to both make the changes, to try to do the maintenance, and of course for our young people, the development. Too often, one of the key problems that the behavioral scientist in particular, who's very involved supposedly in work in this area, one of the key problems they've had is they have not made the adequate differentiation between health behavior change and health behavior maintenance. And so they've devised a technique which does successfully change behavior. They've said, fine, we'll just keep using it because it has changed behavior without stopping to think that perhaps the processes which maintain behavior may be quite different than the processes which get us to change the behavior in the first place. One of the more interesting approaches, and I will only spend a few minutes on this, and hopefully perhaps because you have one of the world's experts here at UBC, and hopefully sometime he'll be able to talk to you about it. One of the most promising approaches to lifestyle and health has been the development of the health risk appraisal instruments. Again, pioneered in Canada and now increasingly popular in the United States, these instruments range from simple self-test, self-scored questionnaires with do-it-yourself suggestions to elaborate that means expensive. Multimedia productions, computer-scored and analyzed reports with extensive data presentations and complex actuarial predictions. But the underlying assumption upon which all of these 20 instruments are based, however, concerns encouraging the individual to reduce his or her disease risk, as exemplified by some form of calculated health age as compared to your actual chronologic age. And to do this through behavior change and health-enhancing directions. So if your age, your chronologic age, is 52, and your health age is 57, then you've got something to think about. Now, if we were to take that particular approach, well, all right, although the evaluation data is not complete at this time, there are indications that these techniques are at least moderately effective as a public health strategy for motivating people to examine their current lifestyle. Whether you do something about it or not, something else. But at least you'll start looking at it. And awareness is perhaps the first thing that we need to inculcate. The more sophisticated programs provide specific projections in terms of health age, reductions, in other words, increased longevity, for specific behavior changes like wearing seat belts, quitting smoking, increasing daily exercise. And for example, if you put down on there you only wear your seat belts an average of twice a week, some of these programs will say if you wore your seat belts six times a week instead of twice a week, you would have in fact an increase or a decrease in your health age by X number of months or years. So they are, again, actuarial predictions, and as we said before, probability estimates, but nonetheless, they give us something to go by in terms of some quantifiable number, which, of course, we tend to gravitate towards anyway. However, keeping this in mind, if we were to think about that, what are the levels where health hazard appraisal might be most effective? Well, in fact, probably quite a few more than most specific strategies. For example, in the intrapersonal health behavior change area. In the intrapersonal health behavior maintenance area. In other words, this is something which you see and which you have to discuss with yourself, perhaps with someone else, but you have to make the decisions in terms of what you want to do. Very personal kind of thing. In terms of, however, it also involves the intrapersonal area, in terms of health behavior change and health behavior maintenance also. Because you are involved perhaps with your physician, you're perhaps involved with your family, because some of those changes clearly will involve other people and may involve your spouse, usually wife, for example, in the case of a husband at high risk, who may be making certain changes in dietary patterns, assuming she does the cooking, which is not necessarily the way it is these days, but let's just assume, for sake of no argument, that the wife is still primarily doing the cooking, primarily controlling diet. Now, and what about this area over here? What about health behavior development? Well, let's stop and think about it. Health age, does that really impact a child? You've got to keep in mind that these instruments' greatest asset, health age, may be of limited or no value in dealing with a population which has not seriously considered its own mortality, which I think is very nice. Young people. Motivational values associated with peer acceptance, with opposite sex attractiveness, with independence from control by authority figures. These are far more powerful than longevity or quality of life. So clearly that type of strategy wouldn't make sense over in this area. So this gives us, again, a little bit of a way of looking at a given strategy and seeing where we might best plug it in. Okay, so this approach may be more effective in terms of health behavior change and maintenance with a middle and late adulthood population rather than for health behavior development. But we've got to go further than this, frankly, because this is actuarial. And that's nice, again, for broad numbers. But for you and for me, we need something more than that. We must ultimately determine exactly who is at risk for what, by virtue of having one or more risk factors, so that we can reduce the present broad range of concerns with which every individual must come to terms. We are being bombarded all the time by do this, don't do that, do something else. Nope, sorry, we were wrong. What we told you you should have done, now you shouldn't do. You know, that kind of nonsense has got to reduce itself to a manageable level. Otherwise, obviously, the credibility of the entire system suffers. Everyone is not equally susceptible to the various risk factors. There's some of you here who could eat cholesterol until forever. It wouldn't affect your cholesterol levels, nor your risk factor in that regard. But we have to develop some means by which each individual can be assessed in terms of his own individual risk. So we don't understand the individual contributions, much less the synergistic potential for combinations of risk factors on health status. But we're learning, and in the meantime, the potential risk of any lifestyle change appears to be heavily outweighed by the potential benefits. So, why not? We may even feel better for it. Now, John Milsom from the university, in his chapter on the health hazard appraisal in the behavioral medicine text, put it most succinctly when he said, to promote healthy life by preventing death and disability due to reducible risk, we would add life to your years rather than years to your life. All right, well, this in any event seems to be what's happening. That is risk factor reduction on this side. It's a little hard to read, even for me. We can see teenage girls here, as I mentioned before. The risk factor is going in the wrong way. But everyone else, and particularly in the exercise area, we are seeing major changes in health behavior. And what has been the effect? The effect? Well, if you stand on your head, you'll realize that the effect has been a decline, an overall decline in mortality, and specifically, sorry about that, the decline has been specifically in cardiovascular-related disorders, stroke, heart attack, as a compared to non-cardiovascular. Here you see a 10% reduction up through 78. In the cardiovascular disorders area, 25%, and stroke, roughly close to 40% reduction. Now, we're not saying that one's caused the other. All we're saying is that we seem to be doing something right. And so, while we're at it, okay, last word. Finally, why has lifestyle change become so popular? Well, perhaps in this world of increasing regulation and technology and gradually shrinking personal freedoms, it's nice to know that you can do something for yourself once in a while, something which you have control over, something that will have meaning to you and to others who are important to you. And that you may even wind up feeling better than you did before, maybe better than you've ever felt since you could remember. What a nice thought to leave you with. Thank you.
Our speaker will answer questions, so if you would please raise your hand, I'll identify you as the questioner, and I'll ask the speaker to repeat the question so that the rest of the audience hears it. Any questions?
How about the addition of inorganic chemicals for the preservation of food?
Well, that's a... what about the presence of inorganic, the addition of inorganic chemicals for the preservation of food? That's a tough one. And I wouldn't pretend to be an expert in that area, even super knowledgeable about that area. We have an inordinate amount, if you have ever looked, for example, at any listing of the amount of sodium in preserved foods. Just look down the list and you'll see small numbers, and you will come to a canned food. And the number will not go up by a factor of 2 or 3 or 5 or 10. It may literally go up by a factor of 50. Look at it, because it's worth looking at. Obviously, we do need some sodium in the system, Edward Fries and the hypertension people notwithstanding. Sodium does play a role, an important role in our system, but the question is how much? And probably we're taking in more sodium, far more sodium than we need, particularly through preserved foods, and I think to the extent we can reduce this, the better off we'll be. But I won't say more.
Three-dimensional model, one of the factors is work site or school. Wondering, is any study, are any studies being made now in regard to the use of the work site as a place where you can improve your health? England, for example, is a company-sponsored exercise program and so forth. What steps are being taken in the United States now?
About 3 years ago, there was a conference held in Washington, it was a government-sponsored conference, which brought together industry, insurance companies. The question referred to what sorts of activities are going on in industry at the work site in terms of health improvement programs. About 3 years ago, a conference was held bringing together industry, insurance people, the medical officers from various companies, and as well as the executives, the CEOs for the chief executive officers of the companies, behavioral scientists, and a variety of others, to sit down to discuss this issue. From that conference, we realized that there were perhaps two or three programs that were already in their initial stages. Since that time, there's been an explosion of programs. So now, I couldn't say at this point how many industries are now either thinking about or have actually implemented programs at the work site involving health promotion activities. One company in particular, Control Data, has really made a major investment. I mean, a multi-million-dollar investment in just developing software in terms of actual programs which they're working with their employees and then ultimately will merchandise to other companies as health improvement packages. And so they have made what looks like something in the neighborhood of a $10 to $12 million investment in this. But Kimberly Clark, Johnson & Johnson, Ford Motor Company, a lot of very large companies have invested considerably. I guess there's one problem in this area. There is a tendency on the part of industry when they want to do something like this to immediately say, well, what kind of a facility should we build? Unfortunately, I think that that's all very well and good, except that the amount of money to put together physical facilities might be better spent if one has, assuming limited resources, on very carefully surveying what really needs to be done, because a track or a swimming pool can literally absorb the entire resources that a company would put in this area for a while and perhaps that wouldn't be the most effective use of those funds.
In here too, you didn't show the home.
You just reminded me that, in fact, for some reason, that was left off. It should have been individual slash family on that cue. So you're absolutely right. The question was, is how come you left family off? And a highly congested situation, an apartment in a high-rise. Well, you have a whole host of confounding factors there. Some people did studies on this with regard to noise and what effect noise would have as a stressor, and they found that the higher you lived in the building, the study was done on academic achievement. And they found the higher you lived in the building, the better your academic achievement was. And they attributed it to the fact that there was a tunnel underneath the apartment house and that the noise coming up was creating a problem for the children. But then someone finally realized also that the apartments up there cost more. And so when she figured in the socioeconomic status of all, they're very complex problems. Yes. The question is, have any studies been done on loneliness and unhappiness with regard to physical illness? Yes, there have, and there are. This is an area which is probably one of the more exciting and alive areas concerning the other side of the coin, which is the risk. We have. In fact, you may have read just a couple of days ago, there was a syndicated column, Leonard Syme from Berkeley had just released the data from a study that we were funding. He told the newspaper before he told us, which wasn't very fair. But nonetheless, that social support, the way they interpreted it was loneliness causes heart disease. Well, we're not sure it causes it, but sure enough, social support seems to be a key factor in terms of one's risk for heart disease. And I don't have the slide, but it very clearly demonstrates that people who are alone and isolated in terms of single people are at much higher risk than married people, and divorced people and separated people are in between. And it seems to be a fairly direct and linear function. There are now studies being done on depression. And in terms of the biochemical correlates of depression and what effects these might actually have in terms of heart damage or in enhancing coronary artery disease. So it's a very exciting area. Can I duck that? Has the Surgeon General or anyone else made any comment concerning the exporting of tobacco to third world? Exporting the industry to third world countries. We have, I mean, you're touching, of course, a very sensitive area in the sense that we clearly have demonstrated without any real question anymore that smoking is clear is probably the most significant risk factor. In fact, probably more significant than any other two put together in terms of at least the not so much in terms of its intensity, but in terms of the consistency of the data. On the other hand, we have a very active tobacco constituency. one of the unfortunate aspects of being in a democracy where everybody has their say is some people wind up having a larger say than others. And in this case, apparently the tobacco industry is stronger than the health industry. So I think that in answer to your questions, the consequences of that, I think, spill over into all kinds of areas, including the one that you mentioned, that we still have a very clear-cut problem in terms of dealing with the tobacco industry in all of its forms, including the export of the industry elsewhere.
I think two more questions should suffice for our speaker. Gentlemen here and there. So start it.
Well, that would probably be in the end. Actually, I'm sorry. The the question was that when we showed death rates by age group, but the 15 to 24 year olds seemed to be increasing. In other words, the death rate was decreasing. I see. Okay, I don't believe that there was any difference. In other words, that these were significant differences. And of course, when you are looking at this type of data, the amount of variation that you can expect would be such that the trend lines are very difficult to determine. The 15 to 24 year old age range is not one that is generally susceptible to disease as such. That's really where you find the majority of accidents, motor vehicle accidents in particular. And that, of course, may be dealing with a whole host of things like seat belts, like the tremendous increase in motorcycles. You know, when I was a kid, to own a motorcycle, you really had to be kind of a bad boy. Today, owning a motorcycle is perfectly legitimate, justifiable, and even a status symbol. Wearing helmets was not a problem in our time because there weren't any, unless somebody put on a football helmet. They just didn't exist. Then we had helmet laws, then we don't have helmet laws. You'll see death rates just bouncing all over the place, and that's the age group where you're probably seeing most of the motor vehicle kinds of activity.
Last question.
Since your talk seems to rule out
that
any safety factors for the alcohol measure or food, can we at least rely upon safety and sex?
Well, I told you I would leave you something. I won't even tell you the data. That's a nice note to end things on. Thank you.
Dr. Peter Sintfeld, the head of the psychology department, will thank our speaker for the question.
I can't unbox it. Okay. I think the Institute has a long history of providing lectures that are enlightening, informative, and occasionally entertaining. Very seldom, I think, does it have a lecture that also sends us home with something to do in our own lives. I think that's quite a change. There's one aspect of the presentation that Dr. Weiss didn't specifically say anything about, but I think that it ought to be brought to your attention. Those of you who are interested in the issue of health psychology, holistic medicine, and so on, may be familiar with a recent book by Norman Cousins called Anatomy of an Illness, in which, among other things, Cousins discusses how he helped himself and his physician jointly to cure a very severe and debilitating illness by the systematic use of massive doses of humor and laughter. Well, laughter is the best medicine, as the Reader's Digest used to say. And I think that the inclusion of all the cartoons and the jokes in the presentation, I don't know whether this was deliberate on Dr. Weiss's part or not, but I think we ought to thank him. He may have been giving us both a treat and a treatment at the same time.
Yeah, right.